This is BCFM 93.2.
I make the radio rock.
Bristol's finest.
Nazism did not die in the ruins of Berlin in 1945, nor on the gallows at Nuremberg in 1946. It merely buried its uniform, slipped into mufti, and sauntered into the post-war world.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Three years after the 2014 Maidan coup, Kiev announces a referendum. They want to join NATO. Yes, and also Ukraine's military is opening up this week on residential areas in eastern Ukraine's Donbass. Plus, with 80% of NATO's war efforts now going into psychological warfare, and most of that by the use of the mainstream media, where does fake news fit in? Here on the BCFM Politics Show at thisweek.org.uk, we have developed our own fake news page for this show called Diamonds in the Cesspool, where we look at some of the best researched and sourced news websites in the whole world. And guess what? They appear in the CIA and Google's list of so-called fake news websites, mixed in with all the rest. Funny, because I thought journalists were supposed to sort out the truth from the lies, not mix them all up as much as possible to confuse the planet. Yes, on our show page there, on a special page now, we also link to the main propaganda sites that list this so-called fake news. And did you notice that Google launched their fake news warning app on the 15th of November 2016, that's just 2 days before Angela Merkel and Barack Obama's famous press conference where they warned the world of this supposedly new phenomenon. Were Merkel and Obama on Google's PR payroll? As we hear tonight from a former British Army psychological warfare officer, there's nothing new at all about fake news and its use in psychological warfare. It goes back at least to the Romans. Yes, the media war's on once more to bend our minds, folks, so how do we read between the lines to find out what's really going on? Also, with repeated warnings from NATO and others about Russian cyber attacks, the government's forced dependence on the internet has made us all vulnerable. So, if an attack comes this year or anytime soon, as we're being told, who will be really behind it? And how can we prepare? In another first for the show, we look at something called prefabs, the BCFM politics show's equivalent of the World War II Anderson shelter, how you at home can prepare for a cyber attack. Our sister show Dialects here at BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. And this week you can hear an extended interview with Sven Hughes, this former psychological warfare officer. To begin with, though, we're joined in the studio by Mike Campbell from Save Our NHS, is it, Mike?
Protect Our NHS.
Mike, just give us an idea about this latest stage. I think they're called the STP. What does it stand for, first of all?
Well, I was going to say, could I just pick up the point about truth that
Sure.
you've just been talking about? Because it links in very helpfully with two points I'd just like to make to sort of kick off the evening. One is that last week we have Theresa May, the Prime Minister, announcing in the House of Commons that the National Health Service is not being privatised. On that very day, Gloucestershire health services, community health services, are handed over to a private company, Care UK. And I think what we need to to be talking about at the moment is actually what is happening with the National Health Service. And as far as I'm concerned, I think we are increasingly seeing a health service that is no longer national. And I hope we can sort of concentrate and talk a bit about what actually is happening with the health service and try and get at the truth of what is happening. And the other example I would give is that Simon Stevens, chief executive of the NHS, was being questioned by the select committee, audit committee in the House of Commons a couple of weeks ago, and he was questioned about real terms funding of the health service. And despite Theresa May and the government's claims that the health service is being increasing its funding, he said in real terms the amount that is going into the health service per person per population is reducing. And I think those are two kind of facts that we've got to get across in talking about what's happening at the moment.
Well, thanks very much for that, because this is, all these politicians have a great opportunity to speak to the nation. And I suppose the opposition has really got to be very quick off the mark to say, well, hang on, that's a lie, or that's simply not the case. Anyway, tell us what's happening in South Gloucestershire. That sounds quite important.
Well, this is in Gloucestershire. You've got a whole range of community health services, which include the 111 service. This is, as you know, it is the service that you ring if there is an emergency at home and you need ambulance. A whole range of services were being run by a community health NHS in Gloucestershire. And Care UK, which, as you know, runs the 111 service in Bristol via Harmony, and a whole range of other services across the country, and includes Emerson Green, by the way, the treatment centre there, they have actually won the contract in Gloucestershire. So there's a whole raft of services have just gone straight over across to the private sector. These are services that the NHS, our tax, the money we pay in our tax, is paying for, but it is actually leaving the health service and going into private hands. And frankly, if we don't do something to turn this around, our health service will be within 5 to 10 years within private corporations' hands. And I have to say, the prospective trade deal that the UK is going to probably make with the US over the next few years will increase the likelihood of US companies taking over health services as well.
Now, the 111 service, I seem to remember, this is a couple of years ago now, some part of the country where it had been privatised, it turned out that the people who were answering the phone calls on that service weren't even qualified.
Yeah, I think, Tony, we talked about this the last time I was on the show, where in Devon there were nights when there was not a single trained medical practitioner on duty to advise callers on the 111 switchboards.
So basically you've got somebody who's answering a call, they're then going through a kind of flow chart depending on whatever you say to them, and they don't necessarily have any actual proper medical training themselves.
No, and I have to say they're under enormous pressure as well. There have been problems in a number of services across the country with turnover, with the lack of training, and the separation. I think this is quite important, the separation of these services from mainstream health services such as ambulance, emergency departments and so on.
Well, the latest to sort of appear on the horizon is this STP. These are the Sustainability and Transformation Plans. What's that looking like for here in Bristol?
Well, in Bristol, and again, it's another jargon term, isn't it? Sustainability and Transformation Plan. What does that mean? Well, let's first of all shorten it to STP, and let's actually be blunt that it's about cuts. It's about in the Bristol, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire area, facing up to £305 million cuts from between now and 2020. And that, without doubt, will have an impact on the services that you and me and our listeners, the people who visit GP practices, people going to hospital across the region, they are going to face changes in services, about which people need to be consulted, by the way, and also cuts in services.
So what's it looking like here in Bristol? Because apparently this is a consultation, but it does look as if a lot of the decisions have already been made.
Well, What we had in December was a document produced by the local clinical commissioning group, and the clinical commissioning group is the organisation that purchases and provides services, producing this document that was called the Sustainability and Transformation Plan. That was sent to NHS England with data that still many people have not seen with regard to the funding budgets for the next 3 years. And I think the important thing for listeners is that whatever condition you suffer from, and you may be healthy now, but you know there are going to be times when you need to go to the doctor, whether it's because of a flu, or you may have diabetes, or you might have a problem with a musculoskeletal problem. You will find there will be changes in the way that service is going to be delivered over the next 3 years. And yes, you know, many of us think there are parts of the NHS that need to change and improve as technology improves. But when it comes down to it, what the STP is doing is limiting services on the basis of money, not on the basis of health need. And the STP is part of the plan, the government's plan, to save £22 billion for the health service over the next 3 to 4 years.
One of the things we keep hearing is NHS trusts going into deficit, then having to beg more money from the Department of Health. I did see a rather good website. It's called nhscampaign.org. That's the NHS Support Federation. And a map on there, Mike, is pretty shocking. It shows maps of Britain of all of the health trusts, or the health areas, I guess they are. They're bigger than the trusts. And it starts off in 2013 with all of the entire country being able to balance the books. When we get to 2014, there's about half of the trusts in deficit. And where we are now in 2016, every trust or every area of the country is in deficit. And I'm just looking over to quickly have a peep at this. Yeah, up to 50 million in deficit each one. Now, actually, at the end of the article they've got here, it says that the true deficit, they reckon, is around about 3.5 billion for the entire country. So how on earth is the NHS actually carrying on day to day with that sort of deficit?
Well, I think that's a really good point. And I can't see the screen from where I'm here. And I don't know whether you can see.
Well, I'll put a link up
North
on our
Bristol, North Bristol United Hospitals Bristol Trust.
Well, yeah, they're in the red, very much in the red, the dark red.
Exactly. And in fact, what they are under pressure to do is to deliver by 2020 a surplus, at least a surplus, at best a surplus, at worst a budget that hasn't got a loss. And I was at the clinical commissioning group meeting in Bristol earlier this week, where I asked the question of the CCG that where NHS trusts cannot meet the requirements of NHS England to produce a surplus, which means they've got to make a profit, i.e. save money, will they be fined as a result of that? And we have the ridiculous situation at the moment that if a trust, and let's take Southmead Hospital as the example, that if they don't meet NHS Improvement, which is the organisation within NHS England that is monitoring money, if they don't produce the surplus that is required, they will be fined, and that means they'll be even worse off in deficit terms. So we have a really crazy situation at the moment where harder you try, the more likely you could actually be fined and lose more money.
So who are these people within the National Health Service who are doing this?
It's terribly complicated. And one of the things that I find when I come on shows like this is that you start getting into trying to describe NHS organisations and the various parts of it. But what we have is NHSI, which is the National Health Service Information, which is the part of the NHS which looks at and deals with the money side of our health service.
They sound like the hatchet men. If they're coming along fining people,
I think you could probably describe that as a description. I wouldn't want to comment on that, but it's certainly a good description. But going back to the STP, is that you at the moment you've got both Southmead and UBHT, the True Trusts, in deficit, And they have got to find a way of getting out of that deficit. The only way they can do it is to save, and in my view, cut services. Now, there's another problem here, which you've probably touched on in with your other guests over the weeks, which is what's happening in the local council. You have massive cuts facing social care at the moment. Southmead Hospital, 25% of the beds are occupied there are people who should not be in hospital, but should be in the community being supported through social care. Until you sort out social care, then you're not going to sort out the health service. And those two big crises at the moment are going to create a perfect storm for the health service over the next couple of years, if not sooner.
Now, you say you're going along to the clinical commissioning groups. Are there other places that people can go along and actually see this in action?
Well, I would never say to somebody, advise, if you're looking for a good time out, to go down to a clinical commissioning group. But actually, what we have found, and a number of us do go, and they're very open, the members of the board, which include local GPs and officers of NHS, are very open about a number of the issues which we feel need to be challenged on. And so we ask questions every time about what is happening regarding to the health service. What is the impact going to be on patients? How are patients going to be involved in being consulted?
What about the big trusts? Are they as open to scrutiny?
Yes. I have been to the North Bristol Trust board meeting, and they are very keen for patients, local residents, to go along and ask questions about what is happening to the health service. And I think one of the problems is that if you're not aware of what's going on, and you know that you can get an appointment with your local GP, and that's becoming more and more difficult as funds are being cut, I've got information about that as well. Unless you're really aware of what's going on through checking out information through websites, through going to meetings, it's actually very difficult to keep up with all the changes.
So tell us about those GP cuts then.
Well, we're doing a bit of research on cuts to GP services, and a number of surgeries in the North Bristol area will be losing up to £200,000 per year over the next few years as a result of a change in formula for the funding of GP services. Now, we'll have more information on this over the next few months, but clearly at the moment there is a crisis in the recruitment of GPs and the retainment of GPs in services across the country, and Bristol is affected as much as anywhere else.
I suppose the other side to all of this is you know, whereabouts is all this heading? When is the next kind of stage with the STP, with this consultation, and when are we going to know a little bit more about? And I'm imagining we're going to hear things like this department's been cut, this hospital's going to be closed, that sort of thing in the Bristol area.
Well, to be fair to the local STP, we're probably better off than a lot of areas where hospital closures have already been announced. We are waiting to see what might happen over in Weston. Weston Hospital, I think, is under threat, but we'll need to see the details of the operational plan for Weston. There will be a number of what have been described as operational plans. This means that each trust, and in Bristol that will be the Mental Health Trust, the Southmead and Bristol Central Trust, each of them will be producing plans to identify what savings and hopefully as well what improvements to service they can make. But all this change is going to take time, and any change that has evidence, an evidence base for improving services, is going to take much longer than just 2 or 3 years. But in 2 or 3 years that money is going to be cut, and that's the problem. The government is rushing through these cuts at a pace that I'm not sure the NHS can really survive.
Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This, to me, feels a little bit like this is the coming down from the 2008, really, that the government's run out of money because it's bailed out the banks, and that's why we're having to make all these cuts.
Well, basically, that's true, but they're also ideologically opposed to the National Health Service, although they don't like to say so. So there's two things going on. There's the macroeconomic mismanagement. You know, we're bailing the banks out and protecting the bonus payments of the City of London, but the NHS has got to cut its coat according to its cloth. And then, of course, there is actually an ideological desire to break the National Health Service, which the Tories are very unwilling to articulate publicly. But if you look at the minutes from 30 years ago from the first Tory cabinet under Margaret Thatcher, they were openly discussing, you know, this will mean the breakup of the National Health Service and a good thing too. You know, the sort of outside of the box. Because the National Health Service is a very successful socialist institution. It's the most efficient healthcare system in the world. Nobody disputes that in terms of bang for the buck, in terms of efficiency, because it's a planned system, even though it's been messed around with through the internal market and so on. It's still superior in financial terms to any insurance-based system.
Mike, I'll never forget seeing the Duke of Edinburgh, and I think it was 1970s television or 80s or something, talking about the NHS as a sacred cow. This is something that we're not allowed to criticise, much as he'd love to. And then also Conservative politician Oliver Letwin actually doing a pamphlet about how to dismantle the National Health Service back in the 1980s. But look, the main thing here, I think, is, you know, you're talking about talking to doctors, clinical commissioning groups. What about the staff? How is morale, do you think?
Well, I mean, in all this, I think staff are tremendous. I think they continue to work under enormous pressure. I meet GPs regularly. There are a number of people in our group who work in the NHS who are absolutely tireless in trying to deliver the best care possible, but they are demoralised. They've experienced pay cuts, and I think that my main concern, and I think Martin's hit it right on, that the sacred cow, however, is being carved up and being turned into bits of meat that is then being handed over to the private sector. And that's the ideological issue. And you're absolutely right. Not only Oliver Letwin talked about privatisation of the NHS, but Jeremy Hunt, actually, in a foreword to that booklet you mentioned, he also has talked about the privatisation of the NHS as being the desirable end for a Tory government.
Frightening. Anyway, you can find Protect Our NHS. You can find it online. It's protectournhs.wordpress.com, which is the blog. You're on Twitter, I think, at NHS Hour. And that's just the letters NHS Hour on Twitter. And it would be nice to get, you know, a little bit more regular updates, because I'm concerned that this is getting to the point where, you know, people are beginning to really seriously suffer and not being able to get the help that they need through the GP, going to casualty, and then finding there that there's massive long delays if they can get seen at all at casualty. And then they're told, well, you know, actually there's nobody to see you here, which is, we're getting to the point where... Well, more like the American system, where, but you've got to get your chequebook out before a doctor will look at you. So anyway, Mike Campbell from Protect Our NHS, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thanks, Tony.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Start this week on our international roundup, Martin, by looking at the Ukraine. I was horrified to see on some of the international channels, although not on our UK channels, pictures of residential areas just being shelled in the Donbass in Ukraine.
Yeah, I was actually scheduled to do a discussion about this on Russia Today this week, but the BBC studio was unbookable for some reason. There's the Poroshenko regime in Ukraine.
But how does this fit in with the arrival of Trump? I thought he was supposed to be friendly.
Mildly progressive part of the Trump platform is to tone down the rhetoric about Russia and to try and build a relationship with the government there. But of course, there's always a possibility of the Pentagon and the CIA and other interested parties, you know, having a strong interest in basically sabotaging that kind of development, as we saw in Syria with the attack on Deir ez-Zor, which killed over 80 Syrian soldiers, in which the RAF shamefully took part. That was actually in defiance of Kerry and Obama's opening to the Russians. You know, they just basically said it was a mistake, we've killed these Syrian soldiers, but that actually killed the ceasefire. So I think what will happen with Trump is, where he's being sufficiently militaristic, i.e. vis-a-vis Palestine, Iran, China, the military-industrial complex are pretty happy with him. Some of them are not so happy with his more pacific remarks about Putin, but they can always sabotage that by just getting on the phone to their friends in Ukraine and say, you know, shell a few of the capsits, as the derogatory term for the Ukrainian nationalists, for the Russian speakers, and then we can, you know, because if they can restart the war in Ukraine willy-nilly, Trump will be dragged along in the wake of the neo-Nazi Azov battalion and these other far-right groups, which are the only people who are prepared to fight in Ukraine. Actually, the ordinary conscript Ukrainian soldiers don't want to fight at all, so they have to bring in all of these kind of psyched up far right nationalist paramilitaries.
Well, anyway, the matter of potential conflict with Russia in Eastern Europe came up at Prime Minister's Questions, with Julian Brazier raising it this week.
Sir Julian Brazier.
Mr. Speaker, the Russian armed forces regularly carry out large-scale exercises, including with nuclear-capable equipments, on the borders of Eastern Europe. Would my right honourable friend agree with me that the American commitment to NATO is absolutely pivotal in protecting the countries of Eastern Europe from going the same way as already has happened to Eastern Ukraine?
I absolutely agree with my honourable friend. I think the commitment that President Trump has given, 100% commitment to NATO, is crucial in ensuring that we can provide for the security of this country and others in Europe, and particularly for those in Eastern Europe on the borders with Russia. I noted my honourable friend, one of my honourable friends earlier, referred to the fact that the Czech Republic, the Latvian government, the Lithuanian government had welcomed that 100% commitment. And I'm pleased to say that we are playing our part. And something like 800 troops this year will be going to Poland and Estonia as a sign of NATO strength and our belief in maintaining those countries in free and democratic.
Well, the situation vis-a-vis Russia, obviously there's been some hope in some circles that
being
Trump
dashed this week.
Well, yeah, I think the idea that Trump is going to be in a position to talk sensibly to the Russians is deluded. And I think that the obvious way for the hawks in the US administration and in Eastern Europe, for example, the regime in Kiev, to make any talk of Trump's rapprochement with the Russians passé is just to keep ramping up the pressure. Fortunately, I think the Russians are very calm. They're not going to do anything stupid, because they're not stupid.
Look, yeah, but hang on a minute.
Nevertheless, it's still very
appalling. Julian Brazier has got a point, hasn't he? That the Russians are doing all these manoeuvres, aren't they? They're getting ready for a fight.
No, the Russians are manoeuvring their army inside their borders because NATO has turned up mob-handed and started making rude noises at them. What would we do if the Russians were on the other side of the channel having manoeuvres? I think we'd have a few manoeuvres in the south of England.
Or
I seem to remember there was
Scotland, maybe, yeah.
I mean, Russian army is not allowed to be deployed inside the borders of Russia because it's some kind of threat to everybody else is bonkers.
Well, what do you make of this attempt to join NATO now, 3 years after the coup?
Well, I mean, that's been a goal of the extremists in Kiev from the very beginning.
Well, they're just looking for some local protection.
Well, the question you have to ask is, how much are people in Portugal prepared to go to war with Russia for the far right in the Ukraine? Now, the Ukraine is not a democratic state by the standards of Western Europe. It just isn't. Now, they're also provocateurs.
Well, hang on,
they're
looking for a fight. They have elections. They've got elected president, elected parliament.
Yeah, but not in the areas which have seceded from the Ukraine, and that's what the issue is. They don't want to be part of this Ukraine, which was only created as a state in 1991, including Crimea, which had always been traditionally part of Russia until 1952. So these questions of, you know, there is a question about what is a Ukrainian state? It's a new state. It's not got established borders. It clearly hasn't. And, you know, one of the rules about NATO membership is you're not supposed to have any disputes, internal disputes about borders. Otherwise, the whole NATO charter, in theory, means that NATO has got to go to war to protect you. Now, in those circumstances, you've got to be a stable state. I mean, Georgia wants to join NATO, but they've got two breakaway republics in Abkhazia and a South Ossetia, and you could easily find you're being drawn, NATO being drawn into a war over that, nearly was in 2006, because, you know, where does NATO end? I mean, let's face it, NATO is operating in the Hindu Kush in Afghanistan. Why is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization marching around in the Hindu Kush?
Good question. Trump did talk about it as obsolete, didn't he?
Yes, he did talk about it as obsolete, and in many ways, what he was trying to do was to bully the rest of the NATO membership, that they've got to spend more on American weapons, because that's where we'd have to buy them from, because of the threat from whoever. Now, he's actually said he's going to massively increase military spending, even though he wants to make peace with Russia. Without discussing it with the Russians, he said he's prepared to lift sanctions on Russia, provided they make cuts in their nuclear arsenal, although he didn't mention the fact that the NATO is putting anti-missile defences into Romania and Poland, which are incredibly provocative from the Russian point of view, because they've got the potential for a first strike on Moscow. I mean, if the Russians were putting similar missiles into Cuba, you can see what might happen. In 1962, we did see what might happen. But apparently they can do that. And, of course, the agreements between Russia and NATO were that soldiers were not to be deployed on a permanent basis in East European countries. And on that basis, they were all allowed to leave the Warsaw Pact and join the European Union. But they're getting round this by saying, oh, well, they're not permanently deployed. But the point is that the level of deployment is not sufficient either to attack Russia or to defend against Russia if Russia wanted to attack them. It's sufficient, though, to make the current agreements non-workable. So they've got enough soldiers deployed that they're breaking the agreements they've made with Russia. It's just provocation for the sake of provocation, as was pointed out by Steinmeier, who is the German foreign minister until recently, soon to be president of Germany.
Well, we'll see about that. Issue of Turkey came up also at Prime Minister's Questions, which you haven't mentioned there, but I'm sure we'll hear what you think about that in a few seconds.
Deirdre Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Many were surprised that immediately after those cosy images with Donald Trump, the Prime Minister chose to meet with the Turkish president, who's been running an increasingly repressive regime since the failed coup last summer. Can the Prime Minister confirm whether she raised any human rights concerns with President Erdogan? Or as we turn our face from Europe, will it be the policy of post-Brexit Britain to put arms deals before human rights abuses?
Well, first of all, I think the Honourable Lady should recognise that Turkey is an important country in relations to both our security and the issue of migration into Turkey and potentially into Europe. What we also recognise is that Turkey has and continues to host 3 million refugees from Syria, and I commended the Turkish government on the welcome they have given those refugees. And yes, I did raise, and I suggest to the Honourable Lady, she should have just have looked at the press conference that I gave after my discussions with President Erdogan and with Prime Minister Yildirim, in which I made it clear that we had condemned the coup, but we also expected the Turkish government to support its democratic institutions, to support international human rights and the rule of law.
Well, what are we talking about here? We're talking about the situation in Turkey. It's very complex. They've been the Turks.
Which side are they on, Russia or NATO?
Well, they're playing they're playing a game that like NASA played in the 1950s of trying to be friendly with play one side off against the other.
Well, the US tried to get him assassinated as well, didn't
they? Well, they did. I mean, and then it's widely understood in Turkey that that NATO was behind the coup attempt, and that includes presumably British intelligence. And so, therefore, it's not surprising that Erdogan is, you know, he wants to be friendly with Britain, but he's aware that the British intelligence agents are probably cooperating with the Americans to get rid of him. And it was the Russians who tipped him off and prevented him from being assassinated. Now, Erdogan is not my favourite cup of tea, but he does have political support in Western Turkey. In Eastern Turkey, in the Kurdish part of Turkey, he's got no support at all, which again brings us back to the whole question of what is a country and what is legitimacy. Why are the borders of any particular country where they are? These things are disputable. It's not necessarily all fixed.
With the Muslim country travel ban, which has caused so much apparent consternation, even though Donald Trump, to be fair to him, did actually say that was part of his election platform. The thing that bothered me, though, was that this is almost reconfirming this whole thing of, well, Syria, Iran, Yemen were responsible for the 9/11 attacks, when in fact it was likely much more to do with Saudi Arabia, who the hijackers were.
There was all sorts of questions about who was really responsible for the 9/11 attacks. As Trump himself pointed out on the day, there must have been bombs in the building, because I build buildings like this and they don't collapse
anyway,
like that.
His answer to all this is nothing is off the table against Iran. He's planning new sanctions against Iran because they've tested a missile, and Sean Spicer has accused Iran of attacking a US Navy vessel.
Well, that's right. So the idea of Trump the peacemaker is frankly laughable. What he wants to try and do in his clownish way is he might try and do a deal with the Russians over Ukraine, provided he gets a free hand in Syria, and then he's allowed to attack Iran without any interference. But I cannot see that any democratic Russian government is going to accept any of that.
This is worrying, isn't it? Fake news. Press Secretary Sean Spicer, this is in The Intercept, falsely accuses Iran of attacking a US Navy vessel, an act of war. So this is White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer asserting at yesterday's press briefing that Iran had attacked a US naval vessel.
Well, that's right. It's a bit like the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which never took place but became the basis for Congress declaring war on North Vietnam. And there's a whole track record of them doing stuff like this. Either there's no incident at all, or they've actually carried out the incident and then said, oh, we've had an incident, now we're going to war. And you can imagine, as the economy probably takes a turn for the worse during the Trump administration, the temptation for him or some fool to start a war with Iran, with China, with Russia probably as well, or do something silly in Syria, like attempt to impose no-fly zones, all of which is quite capable of, the Trump regime is quite capable of doing. Whether they would win the Third World War is another matter. I think the big hope for humanity, in fact, is that the Russian armed forces are quite capable of defending their country and its interests, and if the West wants a war, they might get more than they bargained for.
And the US is defending a commando raid in Yemen as the death toll to that rises. A lot of civilians caught up in that, which apparently was the first big special operation that Donald Trump signed off.
Yeah, and what's been suggested in the US press is that somebody gave them a tip-off that they were about to be attacked, and that's why the thing didn't work as planned. And that's possibly because elements within the security forces in the US are trying to sabotage Trump. In actual fact, what's really going on in Yemen, of course, is that the British and the Americans are supporting a devastating campaign of violence against the ordinary population of that country. The Saudis have come across the border to do it. That's completely against international law, but we're not only not condemning it, we're supporting it, just as we did in the 1960s, I was reading today. Well, there was a huge secret war in Yemen in the 1960s in which the British were heavily involved. David Sterling from the Special Air Service there, trying to overthrow the Republican regime in
apparently
Yemen.
An eight-year-old American girl was killed in this Yemen raid, which Trump approved. Anwar al-Awlaki's daughter Nawar was fatally shot in an intelligence operation on Al-Qaeda, apparently.
Well, I mean, once Trump gets his name, you know, becomes to be president, he then gets to take responsibility for killing all these people all over the world. It's been going on forever. I mean, Obama used to have a kill list every week, you know, kill this one, kill that one, and you know, there was loads of collateral damage. You know, Trump has now got his hands dirty. You know, the blood is starting to drip, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot more before we're finished.
Also, we're hearing today a machete-wielding terrorist was shot near the Louvre, a soldier shooting a knifeman. Now, one does wonder, if you've got a machete, what is the point of going up to a patrol of heavily armed soldiers and threatening them with your machete?
Well, don't forget that a lot of these so-called, you know, these random attacks aren't necessarily random. You mentioned Gladio in the first hour. It seems to me that a lot of these people who end up doing these attacks have got mental health, drug, alcohol, other issues. They've been in the hands of the law often, petty criminals of one kind or another. Suddenly they get converted to extremist Islam or extremist right-wing ideology or whatever. Then they go out and do nasty stuff. The Berlin attacker who drove the truck into the Christmas market, it's been suggested that he was actually working for the intelligence services as an informant, which is why they didn't bother to do anything about
him. This guy with the machete was trying to get into the Louvre's restaurant, and the police or these soldiers had stopped him. He didn't have any explosives or anything with him. So,
well, I mean, if this incident is terrorist related, which is a big
well,
if,
they've said it is. They've said all right, it is. Well, is there any evidence for that?
Well, what I would say is this: that virtually all terrorist incidents, the Boston bombings, the Brussels airport massacre, the Nice truck massacre, and all the rest of it, they fit a pattern which is very similar to what we saw in the 70s and the 80s with NATO intelligence services pretending to be communist terrorists, pretending or being right-wing terrorists, fascist terrorists. They set up, the history is absolutely clear, Al-Qaeda was created by the Western Intelligence Services as part of Operation Cyclone. It was. The story is that they then lost control of their own creation. And you know what? I'll give you a copper's hunch. They've never lost control of it. And they're still controlling it now, as the Russians, I'm sure, are quite aware. And they often hint that they know more than they say about what's going on. And, you know, ISIS and so on were knowingly encouraged by Western intelligence services, including our own cuddly MI6. And then we pretend that we're against these forces because it gives us an excuse to intervene. And that's how bad things are. In Turkey, people know that the intelligence services are terrorists. In Britain, they think they're all like James Bond.
Now, The Intercept, for me, has become over the last couple of years probably the go-to website almost daily, checking out what they're producing, because they're leaking a lot of stuff, which is, although it's devastating, we had something on the role of the secret US base in Yorkshire, Menwith Hill, a few months ago, which was virtually unreported in Britain at all, even though there was some fascinating leaks about what actually goes on in that base. And this week, Glenn Greenwald and Betsy Reid in The Intercept have released secret documents, which are manuals from the US version of MI5, that is the FBI, which are guidance about infiltration of political groups, political parties, religious groups, and college and campus groups, and various other kinds of highly politically charged organisations. Now, this guidance actually is quite shocking to see, the extent to which the FBI justifies to itself an ability to infiltrate almost any kind of group in the whole United States.
Well, I mean, are we surprised? I mean, at one stage,
I'm surprised at is
the Communist Party of the United States was entirely made up of FBI agents.
This
there wasn't anybody in it. There wasn't an FBI agent.
Virtually no reporting in the Western press. It's almost like this kind of subject is taboo. I remember a year or so ago, or maybe it was even longer than that, we reported on the fact that the FBI had been organising almost all US terror plots. This is, you know, basic facts about the way that you can start to infiltrate a group, but then there's nobody to tell you stop infiltrating that group because you're now controlling that group.
Well, the strategy of tension in Italy and elsewhere was you control the groups and then you make them do nasty stuff, and then you say, oh, we need more powers to deal with these people doing nasty stuff, and it's a self-reinforcing cycle. More funds, more resources to deal with the threat that we've identified and actually we've created.
I mean, we heard this case of Khadija Sultana and her two school friends from Bethnal Green Academy who had been persuaded to go to Turkey and to actually were actually smuggled down by Canadian intelligence. by some guy called Matt, who was running an agent who was a former Syrian army officer who had been turned to work for the Canadian intelligence service with the bribe that that he would get Canadian citizenship. This, you know, this kind of stuff really doesn't get pulled apart and talked about anywhere near enough.
No, it doesn't, and I think people have a vague awareness that in the 1980s the Western intelligence services did support jihadis and Salafis and set up Al-Qaeda, but they can't believe, you know, they're supposed to have got over that now and be much more sensible, which is rubbish, because in Syria it's absolutely clear, it couldn't be clearer, that the Western intelligence services are supporting Al-Qaeda. They are. They're arming them. They're training them in military operations at the same time as pretending to fight them. And of course, this is an absurdity which has been exposed by the Russian intervention in Syria, because they really are fighting them.
And now I'm hoping to get on this programme Annie Machon, former MI5 officer who's now living over in Belgium, in Brussels. And one of the things she told us about, Martin, which I thought was quite fascinating, was a basic little acronym to remember for intelligence officers like her, which was various different ways to persuade somebody to work for you undercover as an intelligence agent. We also had Mohammed Makawi a few months ago on this programme. We played an interview with him. He has a show after us, how MI5 tried to recruit him, really, by getting him into a kind of compromising position and saying, well, we'll look after you, we'll make it all, smooth it all over, but only if you come and work for us.
Yes, well, I think the acronym was MICE, wasn't it? Money...
Do you want to? Can you remember what it was? Go for it. MICE. You're right. There's four letters.
Money.
So you can bribe somebody, basically. Yeah. That's simple, isn't it?
Ideology.
Yeah, so if you believe in Jeremy Corbyn, and you can say, well, you can help Jeremy Corbyn, or you can be part of Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, they just might be
any kind of ideology. Yeah, might be communist.
Yeah, whatever.
Anarchist. Fascist.
And then the other one is, I can't remember.
Coercion.
Yes. Yeah, so that's when you've basically got people by the short and curly. Well, you wouldn't want your compromising pictures with young schoolboys to come out, would you?
This is the role of the child sexual abuse, yeah, to a certain extent.
And then the last one is ego.
Yeah, so...
you just flatter them, you're so important.
MICE. Remember that, folks. That's money, ideology, coercion, or ego. These are the ways that the intelligence services can actually persuade people. Now, that example...
you've got to remember that most of what they do is not people who are full-time in paid intelligence agents, yeah? They use their agents of influence. Well, lots of journalists, for example, have their careers greased and helped by the intelligence agencies, and they're not directly employed. They're not MI5 agents, but effectively they are, because the intelligence services basically function on disinformation. The idea that they're out there to find out what's going on is essentially erroneous. They do try to find out what's going on, obviously, but 90% of what they do is trying to tell people stuff, you know, to make people believe.
So,
stuff.
To what extent are these intelligence agencies collecting information, connecting knowledge, and to what extent are they actually conducting special operations and killing people?
Well, they're doing both, obviously, and they basically use their information in order to try and steer reality in directions that they want it to go in, and that includes things like creating spectacular terrorist events which are then used as a justification for further spending on the intelligence services. I mean, if you talk to people in Eastern Europe who used to live under communism, they understand this logic completely. It's fairly straightforward for them. Yes, of course, that's what happens. In the West, you've got people who really believe the fairy stories that they're told by the media that we live in a democratic society, when we do, but it's incredibly manipulated.
Anyway, don't believe us, folks, but you can have a look at our Diamonds in the Cesspool. This is our new page, which is a directory of the CIA's fake news blacklist. So what we're really doing, I mean, what I've done anyway, is to go through some of these so-called fake news blacklists to pull out some absolutely riveting websites, and really ones which are very, very well resourced. Why is it, Martin, that they've mixed up some of these well-referenced, well-resourced websites, one of which, by the way, was recommended in the Benn lecture in 2006 by the late Tony Benn. He was saying that Information Clearinghouse was something that he used every day, and they list that, the CIA and the BBC do, as a fake news website.
Well, you know what? I mean, it's quite interesting, really. This is the kind of banned in Boston or the register of banned books by the Catholic Church. The website, there are some crummy websites in there that I can't be bothered with, but virtually all the ones I use every day and are serious, and including mainstream media channels like RT that I do occasional work for, I think what they've done, in fact, is they've pointed people where the information is that they're not telling you. So if you're smart, you'll think, well, hang on a minute, I need to be looking at this because this is what they don't want me to read.
What they do is they mix them
up
with the rubbish websites.
Well, they mix them up with the rubbish in order to create
you don't have to do that, folks, because I've had a go at doing it. And by the way, if you don't agree with what I've put on there, or you want to add some criticism, comment of your own, there is a comment page on there. So it's not as if we're like the BBC, where it's almost impossible to comment on anything they do on their web pages. You can do that with us. Anyway, what I'd like to do now is just play you a little clip from next Tuesday noon's Dialect programme, where I interviewed former psychological warfare officer Sven Hughes about this very subject of fake news. And he explained, this goes right the way back to the Romans.
It goes back much further, of course, than the Second World War. I mean, it goes right the way back to Genghis Khan. The Roman Empire were using these kind of techniques. Okay. Genghis Khan was using saddles that were far too big on horses, on huge horses, and sending those towards the enemy before a fight, on the night before a fight, so that the enemy would believe that they were fighting giants. You know, communications to achieve an effect, a behavioural effect. In the same way as it would be often the case from warfare way back when, of people leaving one person alive so that he could go and tell the deeds of the victorious side to other people so that they wouldn't fight them. You know, there are lots of war fighting techniques that have used false information, false flags, right the way through the Second World War with the political warfare executive and Operation Mincemeat. But this is happening, of course, today, right now. I mean, if you look at the Quebec shooting, what can we look out for? What should we look out for? I think the Quebec incident recently was a real case in point, which is, in fact, the suspect was a 27-year-old white French-Canadian, Alexandre Bissonnette, if I pronounce his name correctly. When that shooting happened, the first things that social media were saying was, this was a Moroccan, this was a Syrian refugee. Now, that was on RT, and that was on Fox. These were on mainstream broadcasts.
That's right. It wasn't just social media. It was the mainstream media that were saying that, wasn't it? And, of course, social media were picking up on it.
Exactly. You know, well, no, I think it was the other way around, actually. Sorry, I think it was the bots that were pushing out on social media first, and then mainstream media picked up on it. But then, more worryingly, you then hear the White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, responding to the story, understanding it in those terms, and then coming out with a statement saying it's a terrible reminder of why we must remain vigilant and why the president is taking steps to be proactive rather than reactive when it comes to our nation's safety and security. So even there you have the White House press secretary at least endorsing the Muslim ban on the basis of this story, which he was, you know, obviously receiving false information at the time, or at least listening to false information, when actually it was the Muslim community that was actually suffering. You know, and I think we need to be very, very careful to pause and get our facts right and check the sourcing of our news before we comment. And that's both on social media, and that's the main media, but that's also the politicians as well. The speed of the news at the moment is so fast. I think one of the first things we must all do, if we're in this industry, if we're in the media industry, and also if we're citizens, is to stop and think, has the person I'm hearing this from, are they a respected publication? You know, is it a respected source? And that doesn't mean it has to be mainstream. It also just, are they a respected, trusted source? And it doesn't matter if it's a blogger or mainstream or a politician. You know, can I find this information elsewhere and check it elsewhere? You know, could it be something else? Could it be the agenda of someone else that I'm falling into the trap of following? You know, is it having an effect on me that is intentionally sort of emotionally arousing? Because of course people pass on information that they feel emotionally aroused, whether or not they feel disgust or whether or not they feel anger. You know, that is a way of creating retelling in this space.
That's Sven Hughes. You can hear the full interview on Tuesday at noon on our Dialect show. Martin, a couple of times he's come up tonight, hasn't he? This Sean Spicer guy, not only getting it all wrong about who had been behind the Quebec mosque attack, which I think killed six people, saying it was a Moroccan when it was actually a white extremist and far-right extremist, and also this false accusation of the Iranians actually declaring war on America. Now, this is making quite a lot of big errors, Sean Spicer's doing, getting fake news straight from the White House.
Well, I mean, the fact is, as Sven points out there, the answer to this is for everybody to be very vigilant about what's being said and to be very careful about what their sources are. And I think there's an awful lot of attempts to manipulate us going on, but what we've now got is we've got an army of people who are going through everything with a fine-tooth comb, and we can check everything using the internet. So it actually makes it quite difficult for the psychological warfare warriors to entirely get what they want.
Okay, now also I mentioned at the top of the hour, we've had lots of warnings about this apparent cyber attack by Russia. This really started with the Bilderberg conference, and by the way, exclusively, I've revealed that it looks almost certain that the Bilderberg meeting will be taking place in Chantilly, Virginia, just outside Washington, this year, between the 1st and the 4th of June. Put a web page up, and I'll put some links to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. If anyone is interested in just looking at the potential of booking a hotel, I mean, if you can cancel the booking, because we're not, the Bilderbergers themselves haven't confirmed it, but that looks like that's where it's going to be this year. But anyway, the whole point of this really being to have a look at this cyber attack. Now, look, the problem is, it could actually be the United States, could be the NSA doing it, and they could just point the finger and say, oh, the Russians are cyber-attacking you.
They could. They could indeed. And we rely very much on the internet for checking information. If it went down completely, we'd be back to a word of mouth, etc.
So what can you do to defend against it? Well, I've come up with this little acronym, PREFABS. Not the greatest in the world, but anyway. P stands for passwords. R stands for real privacy. E is email accounts. F is for firewall. A is air gaps. B is backups, and S is software. This is how you could defend yourself from a cyber attack, whether it's from the NSA or the Russians, whoever. We'll start with passwords this week. P is for passwords. Use a complex password and write it down. I would suggest you have about at least 10 passwords. Use your top 5 or 6 for specifically important accounts, like bank accounts, that sort of thing. And then maybe have 2 or 3 passwords for less important accounts, which you can share between accounts. Only keep paper copies. Don't photocopy them, because photocopiers are easy to digitally look at what's been on those photocopiers. And also change them now, I'd suggest, folks. Don't leave it. Get them changed at least now if you can. If you've got an internet service provider, ask them to send you, if they're a good one, or pick up 10 passwords. So you, like Triodos Bank do this, you can phone them up and say, right, we're going to use password number 10 on the phone. You know what it was, and they know what it is, but nobody else does. And I'll do the rest of those in future weeks. So that's P passwords, the first in our prefabs collection. Anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Metro Mayor candidate for Labour, Leslie Mansell. Our show page for your comments is thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.